here for this.
I have been doing.
And all this has been improvised. We certainly suffer a number of handicaps. I think the only decent thing I can do to you without impertinence is to recognize these handicaps and to speak to you about some barriers to teaching. You're teachers. That's my first handicap. I can't teach you easily. You know it all already. But there are some other handicaps in any teaching process. And I think that it is better to face them frankly than to gloss over them with some blind idealism. And I think you will find it quite interesting that only by facing the barriers to teaching can we really meet the great task, the greatest honor that man has when he speaks, that he is allowed to teach. May I illustrate this by some personal stories? One is a personal experience, a kind of family quarrel. I married into a family with five sisters, and so the various brothers-in-law put certain problems to each other. One of my brothers-in-law, who married into the same family, and I came home from the war, both in uniform, and in this home, we appeared to be both officers. Also, we both were teachers. I was a university professor at the time, and he was a grade school teacher. The uniform, of course, made us look very much alike. But one day, he had a flare-up about teaching. He had gone to a teacher's college, and he defended the point of view that the normal situation for teaching was a classroom with at least 30 men in class sitting there and receiving instruction. And I held that for my own use on, I had always liked to teach, but I thought the only normal situation was that between a mother or father and his son saying something that had to be said to him at the right time in a personal situation. And this clash went quite easy. He felt attacked in his most professional honor. He had learned in a teacher's college how to teach. I was just a university professor, and you know we don't learn how to teach. I leave this open to you. What is the normal teaching situation? The second story, a friend of mine was a corporal in the First World War, and at the division corps, the headquarters, they discovered that they had a great scholar in their midst, poor soldier, but great scholar, and historian. And so they had trench warfare and they were very bored, and they wanted to get some entertainment, and so they decided to get this unshaven corporal from the trench up to headquarters, but before he was looked over by one of the men, was he presented. And the men, the officer, very cautiously asked the corporal, well, can you really lecture on history, on world history? Our general would like to hear you speak on universal history. But he said, of course. But how much time do you need? The corporal said, from 1 minute to 10 years. Well, said he, that's impossible. How could you teach world history in 1 minute? Oh, he said, in one sentence. World history begins in the east and moves slowly forward to the west. This is another handicap to teaching. How much time should be given? A minute? 10 years? You know, there are eternal students who like to go to school for the rest of their life. Protected and sheltered situation. And sometimes they tell us that we only teach because we want to be in such sheltered situation. You know, those who can do or who can't teach. I have three barriers to teaching. You're teachers. I come to
prediction.
You can? 30 men?
189, I'm told, are you?
It is too impossible.
I can just speak to a mass. And the third handicap, you remember from my friend the corporal, is too general. The less time given to teaching, the more I must generalize on the topic. So, here I am, my handicap as a teacher is that I come too late. Everybody has already something written on his brain. Old Descartes said, it is terrible, I wasted 20 years with misconceptions and prejudices, and now I have to begin, you see, to become a semantic blank again. But nobody wants to become a semantic blank, he was an exception. And so every teacher comes too late when he wants to deal with students in a college, for example, or when I wish to deal with you. I come too late. That's my handicap. You, as students, you see, are offended because it is too impersonal, what I have to say. I treat you as my brother in law, thought he should treat the class. And by tricks, you see, by gimmicks. And number three, we're talking about the subject in two general terms, not specific. Because we have no time. Now this has to do with the whole question, is there time for teaching? Life is after all running out, you only have one life to live, so why give so much time to teaching? Why not go on acting? And this is our whole educational process is a tremendous waste. It's just putting people on ice. These are the barriers to teaching. And I wish to say that every classroom reflects these three barriers or handicaps or deficiencies. Every classroom, look at this classroom, it is impersonal. It is too general. You can teach anything in this room. It's not a special situation as when you go to the airplane itself and can make people feel that this is one specific airplane, the sacred cow. And number three, too general, too impersonal, and too late. That's reflected in this classroom. And because everybody feels that it is too late, everybody is waiting for the bell. The result is not only boredom. You know this problem, and that people go to sleep, and that people let you talk, and then sit back, and you have perhaps one student who really follows all the time. There is a result from our barriers to teaching, which is much more serious, and on which I am going to speak a little more specifically. Any classroom defies the presence of the human soul or of the divine spirit. I always tell my students in a classroom to better deny the existence of God than the soul. This may seem to you a far flight from your practical teaching, but I will see that it is very practical. In your instruction, and in my teaching, we have to reckon with this resistance that any decent person will speak of his highest beliefs only when it is inevitable and necessary. And a general has to address his troops before debate. He has to speak the truth, that the life of man must be sacrificed for a greater goal. He has to say that. That you and I here in this classroom have absolutely no reason to speak in this unreal and general and impersonal situation about such highfalutin things. And we have to, I think, admit there's a predicament in our situation in any classroom that we must cheapen all our aspirations. Yesterday I had a conference and
One of my friends there resented very much the use of the word inspiration. And I said, well, I haven't used it. I'm not going to use it in a conference room. I'm not going to desecrate the word inspiration by using it before colonels and staff officers. It's an annual situation at conference. I don't have to mention it, so I'm silent about the course. Gentlemen, any classroom omits those things which we only know in an emergency, and which only are at one moment in our lives inevitably fixed. Because the classroom is not the right moment. It is out of time and out of space. What I have said about too late, about impersonal, and about in general means just this, gentlemen. Please take this. For one moment, may stun you. This is a very simple statement. The classroom is unreal. It's an unreal situation. And about the most real, you cannot talk in an unreal situation. You laugh at it. You must have a sense of humor. Cracking jokes in a classroom, gentlemen, is the way out. As you well know, you keep your attention by a sense of humor in a classroom. Anybody who cannot crack one joke during a lecture shouldn't teach. That takes the place of the divine, this little devil. We make clear to the students by provoking laughter that there is a lacuna, that our reality, our dear little situation, is just preparatory to life. It's very important, that we prepare the real situation, and therefore we must admit one thing, which I always tell my friend in the divinity schools, that in their study halls of all these divinity schools, God is treated as absent. Because if they would know, think that he was present, they wouldn't talk about it. Now, I feel, gentlemen, that this would be a real contribution of the military, that you would bring this distinction into your teaching in our colleges. In our colleges, you see, atheism is rampant because it comes from the very real situation of the classroom. In as far as the classroom is something real, it is better treated if we do not speak there about the higher things, but keep them out. It's perfectly natural. Really. You, however, know something, because you are uniform, about the fact that the teaching is just one part of life. There's leadership, there's command, there's war, there's peace, discipline. And for you, obviously, instruction is something exceptional, something interposed, intermittent. It isn't the whole story of your own situation. Therefore, I think you can be much more readily confronted with the deficiencies of the classroom. My colleagues, you see, as any professional, do not like this statement that the spirit is absent from the classroom, because they do not wish to hear that there are any limitations to the teaching profession. That was my brother-in-law, because he didn't understand there was anything amiss in teaching such a teacher's college class. You see, a college is the latest place. And that he just hated the idea that a father could perhaps teach better, you see, than a professional, because then you can't unionize and you can't give people higher wages. So I don't forget your starting point as officers. When you go into teaching, face brutally, frankly, the deficiencies of the classroom. Because perhaps then we may be able to overcome them. Let me go on from this statement. And because I now hear your criticism inside of myself, after all, I make too much solemnity about you and the whole process. You instruct people, you say, you don't teach. course instruction was then simply appealed to the mentality, to the mental forces of an individual or of a mass of people. You are using this famous logic that I have never met in any other teacher, and you produce results by putting it over. Therefore, I would like now to, in the second part, to analyze the teaching process itself, the bias to teaching, draw attention to the fact that by itself in a classroom, instruction, mere instruction, may prevail because the appeal to the logic and the mind and the reason of the student, of course, is much easier than the appeal to his personality in a classroom. But since it is impersonal, and since I come too late in your personal development, you see, I better keep out of trouble by only talking to 2 and 2 is 4. Question, 4 part 2, is it possible only to instruct? Now I would, and let me, because we have so little time, you will forgive me, I'm just in the same predicament as my corporal. I have to show out my rule of thumb, that in every process where a man who knows speaks to a man who does not know, from a sense of duty, there are 3 elements, teaching, instruction, and training. These are not the terms of empty verbiage, because they are addressed to 3 elements in the student, which you and I can verify. Instruction appeals to the mind. Teaching appeals to the person, to the soul. Training to the body. You train them to do things. With his own hands, with his own feet, with his own body. And you really train anybody. Instruction is universal. It appeals to the intelligence, which supposedly everybody has. And therefore it is universal, intellectual, logical, and it appeals to the mind. Now, at first sight, as you can see now, it is for you to enter these anabiotic places called colleges of 35 to 35 degrees of Fahrenheit, just about freezing. The instruction is all that is required, that you can get away without, perhaps even without training, because you have no airplanes on your campus, which I really resent very much. You are condemned to instruct, and you are called instructors. Is it possible to instruct without training and without teaching? Teaching is the appeal to this forbidden something which doesn't exist on campus, the soul, the person. Now I think I will try to explain to you why in every moment when a word of truth is spoken between people, there is an appeal to all the 3 elements in us, the person, the mind, and the body. And therefore I hold that training, instructing, and teaching are necessary terms, which can be just as much verified as ice, water, and steam. It's the same thing in 3 states of aggregate. And as you know, there is such a devastating aversion today to clear thinking that any such assumption must seem to you at first sight ridiculous. You have never heard that there are necessary elements in these processes. You have been, so to speak, everything has boiled down to an appeal to the human mind. I have never seen it possible, and this is now a dogmatic statement for which I wish to be nailed to the cross, but which I also
wish that you will remember, gentlemen. No science can be taught scientifically. You cannot teach any science scientifically. You have to teach it enthusiastically and concretely and personally. No mathematician is a teacher of mathematics if he is just a mathematician. If he just appeals to the mind of a student. He must overcome his student with the importance of his topic, and he must show him the ropes. That is, he must make him physically able to write his equation on the blackboard, which has nothing to do with the human mind, but with my elbow. So this is one of the great superstitions that clouds today the horizon of education. That people really think all these so-called scientists who are just plumbers. No man in research can think so. That science can be transmitted scientifically. It must be science transmitted humanly. And you and I are people who have a body, have a mind and a personality. And these are three different things. And the appeal has to be to the woman. And all the teachers of any science, whether it's zoology or physics or whatnot, are only teachers in as far as they have this power to appeal to you. You see us who in that. The rest is what they themselves do or know. That's something quite different. That has nothing to do with this transmission of power. Can perhaps illustrate a little more what instruction, what teaching, and what training do. Let me use a simile. And a simplified matter. And similes allow us to concentrate, to condense many various difficult problems into a little picture. The mother, a nurse, and a nurse all take care of the sick. And my tendency is to say that a nurse is a nurse. When you go to the hospital, you see a young mother, your wives have their children, they fall under the cure, under the hands of these nurses. But there are some mothers who resent it. Something lacking in the fraternity wards. They are just finding it out at this moment, and they allow some mother to go home very soon because they suffer from this impersonal treatment by the nurses. The nurses have the 8-hour day, and they are well trained. They do all things right, and they beat any mother and any nun in precision of the various movements of their body, from the bedpan to taking the temperature. The nurse is trained. The mother is untrained, usually. Could be trained, but then that's not the situation, normal situation. Then you just think of the mother per se, without any education, without any Simmons. And therefore she is at a loss for certain things that could be done around the child. But she's unreasonable because she is so specific and so personal. And many a patient has been saved by this personal accompaniment of every movement of his own sufferings by the sympathy of the person who loves him and takes care of him. You may know people, there are many stories in literature to try to make this point that life can be saved simply by this immersion of another person into your own dreams, into your fever. So the mother has something, which the nurse does. The nurse has something, the mother does. Then there's a nun who has taken a vow to be available for any person who
comes under our hearing. He may be untrained. And many secular many people in medicine will tell you, oh, we don't need these nuns, they are not trained as highly as we can, as these nurses, they know more science. All right, that's a difference. The nurse is available to anybody, so she has not his personal ties of a mother to her own child. She has his radical manual training, perhaps the nurse has today. She has, as you have as instructor, a devotion to duty, which I, without offending any personal case of nursing, I have found to be missing in many young nurses, because she just has this as a paid proposition, and the main point is to go to the doctor. Now, why did I use a similar? Mother, nun, and nurse. Because I want to stress the point that they are all three necessary. They fertilize each other's minds and each other's actions. You cannot have just motherly care. You cannot just have nursing, and you cannot just have religion. Any one of the three is deficient in the qualities that two other offer. And there is a dynamic process. After the last 50 years of specializing in nursing, any mother in America, I'm quite sure, or at least 80%, know more about nursing than they knew 50 years ago, because many of the routines developed by the nurses now have infiltrated, you see, into every private room. Obviously, many mothers now hear in due time how to nurse. So without the rationalization, without the specialization of the expert nurse and a high grade of training, the mothers would still be too primitive. So there is a constant step, and there are then dynamics, gentlemen, between training, instruction, and teaching. There is a constant process of interchange. Every one of these ways sharpens the process and drives it to higher perfection. That woe to the nun and woe to the nurse who is not willing to admit that in certain cases a mother does wonders. The very wonder the nurse cannot work unless she chooses to be a nurse and acts like a mother. Which she may well do, but that's the word that for this would have to break it in our way from it. Now this is then, gentlemen, the, I hope, the contribution of this interpolation of the simile of mother, nurse, and nun. And I mean it. It's meant very severely and very strictly. Teaching, instructing, and training supplement each other not only, but by concentrating on any one of these activities, the two others gain something which by themselves they wouldn't have. I, as a teacher, and I perhaps an extreme case of a teacher, because I have no automobile to show, or no aircraft, and I have no muscle to train, I have only to appeal to you as persons. I am not an instructor at this moment, as you were missing, and I am not a trainer. I am just a teacher. I am in the most frail position. Just like a mother, I cannot appeal to you as a professional. I'm just saying here on one reason, ground, life must be saved, the same that the mother has to do, because you are committed to my care. I have this 1 hour that is so wonderful, I must find out, I must do my darndest. But that's all I have. I have no other argument. My PhD is no good at this moment. Teaching is very frail. Mothers are frail in this respect. They only command the respect in their specific situation with their own children. They cannot go out and, because they are the mother to this child, take care of all the mother, child children in the world. This is no
no degree, no license acquired in general, in personal and for all. So, in the same sense, the teacher, since he just made a appeal to the person, has little tools, very few tools, very few instruments. The trainer has all the instruments he wants, they want to offer. Everything is put at his disposition. Even the time of the students when they should do other work. So, this is clear then they ask certain barriers, that the teacher, like the mother, in the tradition of the last 50 years, has fallen, so to speak, away from public attention. We have concentrated on training methods, on specific methods, or we have made appeals to the rational mind of the student. And we have tried to convince ourselves that any field, any subject matter, can be taught in the same mood as the subject matter itself is treated, objectively, scientifically, rationally. And I here now come and say this is impossible. Nobody has ever learned with interest and fervor from any person who has tried just to be this. There's no contact then between student and instructor. So now, what can help us to recover or restate the right proportion between teaching, instruction, and training for your own perusal in your everyday situation as instructor in a college? I think it is this fact that here I am appealing to teachers. To teach teachers is a great privilege. It is not only the handicap of which I spoke before. I said before that to teach teachers means to speak too late. Mentally, you are all already filled with preconceptions. You know what to do. And why should you wait for me to tell you? But psychologically, as persons, gentlemen, you share with me a responsibility which a student in a classroom who usually doesn't have, you see. You know that you have to be personal. You teach one thing this year and another thing, for example, next year, because in the meantime the rules have been changed. The content of your teaching is not stable. Now, why can you demand the confidence of your student that they should listen to you today, although you may be quite aware of the fact that next year you may have to teach something different in your instruction? It's no longer true. Only because you are truthful, because you are a person who can change his mind. The soul, gentlemen, is that which remains in any teacher when he changes his mind. And I hope that many of you change their minds without changing their personality as a chameleon. You see, the necessity of speaking of personality or soul, which has been rejected by all people who base their thinking on classroom situation, on the abstract situation at their desk, and who do not wish to draw on the necessary situations of an earthquake, a fire, a war, a revolution, a marriage proposal, a great emergency, a death, which they have to survive. All these cowards of the mind do not wish to admit that the mind is fickle, and that therefore I cannot base my existence on my mind. I have to change my mind. And they often, I hope you do too. Since I have to change my mind, I must appeal to myself as John Smith, or whatever my own name is in my own inner self, as a man who can change his mind. Now, who is this man who can change his mind? A man who doesn't depend on the pure truth so far revealed to him, who can go on to a better truth. Now, this road from one truth to another, you see, is only straddled and walked through by what we call the person, or what we call intimately in our inner self, the soul. meeting of the Spirit, he demanded to change your mind. Our pride, the mental pride, forbids it.
We say we know what we, and we owe it to it, you see, to our principles. That any one of you, who are fortunately mature people, knows very well that in the 30 years of your life, in the decades of your living, you had to change your mind, or was false pride, which made you very happy. Because you wouldn't say to yourself, I made a fool of myself.
Now anybody who can say to himself he has made a fool of himself jeopardizes, jettisons his mentality and says this mentality wasn't good enough, then he has a better one. Therefore, gentlemen, I can talk to you better than you can talk to your students about the real situation in teaching, because I can appeal to you the fact that you as teachers know that you cannot base your trustworthiness and your efficiency merely on your mind, on your mentality. Because you have to keep going. Nobody has to change his mind more often, really, than a teacher.
Because, just you and me, we know that we know only those things which we can teach. No student really knows anything, despite examinations. Think the truth as you well must have experienced yourself in your teaching. Come to full life, to full meaning only when we have to teach others. Isn't that true? I think the only man in the classroom who really knows, understands, is always the teacher. By teaching, I come to seize my own knowledge, so to speak, for the first time really fully. Isn't that true? I would like to hear if this is admitted. So the student is just a beginning teacher. He is far as we are able him to transmit what we tell him. You see? As he is a potential teacher himself, he begins to understand. If I now may begin to form the personality, that teaching, instructing, and training are three aspects of the same process. You appeal to the person, the student, as a potential teacher who will trust you because you show him how to change his mind with honor, how to change his mentality, you see, without false pride. Then his experience of being taught is more lasting and important than his experience of what he's instructed in. Because by teaching, you teach him two things. And now he's ignorant, and now he receives something new. And also he receives a certain sentence. But that is only what at this moment enters his mind. He must also get ready to learn something else at some other time, and this was what I tried to set up in this rather strange formula, that you teach the better, the more you treat the student as a potential teacher. Because if he is on the road to teaching himself, you see, if what he takes is accepted by him not as something to be answered in an examination, but also, you see, in a theme to be graded A, B, C, or E. But if he, from the very beginning, admits that what he is instructed in, what is turned into his body, he should be able to transmit to later generations, then you have the man, the real man. Why? You have the person. You have the man who has a long-range, you see, attitude in your classroom. This man won't go to sleep. This man, self-interest doesn't keep people awake. It's very interesting. That's a responsibility to us. And if you can awake in this man the feeling that the great sacrifice Uncle Sam makes in allowing him to become an Air Force officer candidate, you see, that this entails that he enters the chain of command, the chain of inspiration, the chain of tradition, that he is a potential teacher. He must be good. Just as any man on darkness, you see, because there is somebody coming at 10 o'clock to take over. He must find him there. You have forgotten completely, gentlemen,
by excluding the whole problems of real teaching and personality, by dismissing them as inspirational and sentimental pep talk, as unnecessary. That these are very concrete attitudes in every one of us. Very direct, you can test it in any classroom. If you can convince this man that one day he has to teach somebody else, you have his attention. Because that's dangerous. Because he will make himself a difference. Nobody thinks he will be locked out of court. So if you can see in your students a potential teacher, and if he can feel this, you move on a plane in which the whole situation between you and me at this moment, gentlemen, can be envisaged for one moment without speaking of instruction and training. And I would like to use the rest of my time to defining a little more the relations between the modern teachers to potential teachers. On this level, gentlemen, it isn't that I am the first student, but that every student is the last teacher. We have flattered and cajoled our students by always telling them that we were subservient to their needs and interests, and that we would cater to sell them ideas. I think this is deeply shocking, gentlemen. And if you as the military are of this nation fall in with this terrible idea that teaching is advertising and selling, jealous. The American nation can be written off from the surface of the globe. You are the only hope of this nation to take life for what it is. Life is the transmission of acquired qualities in the human race. And teaching is a way of doing this. All these people in biology and genetics try to explain what it is. They don't know. We know. We teach. We transmit acquired qualities of the human race. You know, it's a great thing now between the Bolsheviks and the Western geneticists whether acquired qualities can be transmitted. Well, they just don't know where they are transmitted. They are transmitted right here. We have an eternal job, gentlemen, if we do not confuse it with selling ideas. Any father is a father only if he tells his boy what it's all about. You are not a father because you sleep with a woman. You are only a father when you give his boy your own name. And the name, father, son can say, this is my father. Every great truth, everything you instruct in is only truth when the man, you give the man the security that there has been one man who told him so and demands to be quoted on this truth and to be pinned down for this truth. You can divide the word today into the people who say, this is true, but don't quote it. And the people who say, this is true and you can't quote it. There the line is longer than teaching and gossip. And teachers, says, because they want to become potential teachers, and they must treat them as such, want to be able to quote you for what you have said in serious and in earnest on the principles of service, of obedience, of discipline, or whatever it is, or of truthfulness, of self-criticism, all scientific, I mean precision, accuracy, all these things are part of the eternal truth that has to be propagated from generation to generation, just as a physical germ has to be. Teaching is simply the spiritual side of propagation of the race. It's nothing else. Therefore, I come back to my initial story. I think I was right against my father-in-law. You see, the father is the normal teacher of the soul. And you and I are only supplementing the fact that this father today is a civilian who doesn't know how to fly and doesn't know anything. You see, he, ideally speaking, he should be able to teach his son. And now comes my conclusion, gentlemen, the first conclusion in the third part, that the teacher is always second best.
If you can find a person, a fatherly officer, for example, who is a friend of this one other officer, older general, who takes an interest in the lieutenant, he'll be the better teacher, of course, than he ever can hope to be. It is a greater honor for the teaching profession or the instructors to admit that we are second rate in a great task, in the most tremendous task that the humanity has, which is not physical, gentlemen, propagation, but the transmission of acquired qualities of the mind and of the person, of the character. But we are second rate because we teach too many. We cannot. As a father, I have the privilege of calling this thing my own, and we don't own us. It is an exception that we can permit to think of one of them in such a way that there is a unique situation and a lasting one. But as soon as we admit that we are vicars of the spirit, I think we are perfectly free again to speak of the inspiration and the spirit without any bashfulness. Since we are not the Pope, you see, in the classroom, and we are not the saints, and we are not prophets, but we are only taking the place of this unique situation between any one father and any one son. We have a humility, so to speak, and a detachment from our own job, which allows us to face the real facts and to do a good job, because we know that as vicars we must do our best to fill up this gap, you see, of the which otherwise is there, that we are so impersonal and so general, and so remote from this people's mental history that we come to live. The admission of this barrier to teaching that we face as teachers, that we are just vicars of the fatherhood for which every son prays as an experience, I think will enable us to readmit these processes which all modern textbooks on education, so to speak, have avoided like hellfire because they thought that was not good taste. When I speak to you from a 10:45 to 11:45, and if you forgive me to 11:47, it's still 7 minutes to go. What do we do as teachers and potential teachers, as I would like to make you think about the students? You do not stoop down to the students. You do not condescend. Don't try, and an officer can't try to be one of the boys. This idea of guidance and of the control from the idea that nurses and counselors are the idea which every mother and father in this country should follow. Mothers and fathers, you know, have to be taught by themselves name today, because the office of fatherhood and motherhood seems to be stifling and to dominate. I think you deprive your students, your potential teacher, of a great experience if you decline that you have to teach them. You cannot stoop down to him and say, I'm just learning. You can only make him teach with you. So you must lift him up into a situation to which he doesn't belong. You have really lifted him up into the history of the human race. If I may put it in Bodhijaya. Here's your potential teacher. In his own life, he will be limited by this year. Any time, I mean, given 1980 when he's going to die, oh, that's too early nowadays. The insurance company says 2050. Here you are in 1952. You have your experiences, well, from the beginning of the Air Force, from Orville Wright, on 1908, you represent this past, and many more things. The discipline of the army would get a little further. So you stand in this classroom, gentlemen, here, and I stand here, and try to embody the experience of the race. far before you ever came in contact with them, had any reason to think about it. I must bring this to life, and it must come through me to you. And therefore, gentlemen, a teacher represents more time than his own time span, or his own teacher, or his own practice, the sectarian. I must speak to you out of the whole stream of experience. It's my only responsibility is to sit, to select what you need most. But there must be, you must be sure that no truth is omitted whichever has been, you see, become known. And your student, the piece is there, but if you have this character, this dignity in your person, that you do not think it's just the manual and the textbook, that the manual is only condensing experience all the way. You see, that goes back to Rome and Greece. Even the airport can learn something. I'm well on the way here, actually get down here and book on Roman warfare, how to make camp. I was amazed how much one could learn from building an airport from the way the Romans built a camp. They also have to be clear that the airport camp had to be kept out of the of attack to be protected, that the way inside could be on like a good workshop, like a good factory, you see. So the combination of a warlike situation, you see, in enemy territory, even you see, and smooth running inside was a great concern of Roman camps. That any enemy or anything from the time before aircraft was invented. Now, your student, gentlemen, is a potential future, and the truth must be known in 2000 and in 2050. And you must consider him as a potential future, and a father, then he's a father, good father. Then he treats his son as a potential father. What is sinful against slavery, service, obedience, blind obedience? But any general who treats his lieutenant as a human being doesn't treat him as a human being, but as a potential general. That's why the lieutenant isn't kicked around. It's so simple that I always wonder why this is mentioned. See, as long as you think of your instruction as just giving this man rules of thumb at this moment, you do not treat him as a means to your end. As soon as you develop an innocent that he is taught, because somebody has to teach all of this, you raise him to your own level of equality. And this is the moment. Not the condescension you see to the student in him, but the lifting him up to the rank of a future teacher. You see the difference? And I prefer that we give you respect in somebody who has to go right away in an examination. And this appeals to the best powers in a man, just as the father tells his son all those things which the son will need one day when he has to found a family. In this sense, that in every classroom, something rather miraculous happens. Men act as a time bomb. You come in here, students come in, supposedly open-minded, supposedly able to listen. The assumption, however, is that they are listening not for themselves, but for the whole time in which I will be dead and have disappeared, and everything I know or have experienced is first. You may be younger than your students. Potentially, the teacher is always old. The student is always young. Your student may be 70, but for the purpose of learning, he is the younger, and you represent the old stream of tradition. You see, he enters it as the next link. You can see this. Therefore, gentlemen, old and young in teaching are not physical. Have no physical meaning, no biological meaning. This is not a video, I'm not dealing with zoological specimens in teaching. But we create epochs. Between the teaching generation and the learning generation, there is epoch, is an epoch-making event. Because one generation represents the ideas of the old and tries to energize the younger men, so that they can carry on by word my personality, so that there can be teaching again, and always, and forever. Now, if this happens, you see, my high faith in your being willing to take up the torch, and your hopes that you will take something away out of the classroom, are bound together. A teacher lives by faith, and young people, the younger one, live by hope. And there is one common virtue between the two, which I don't have to mention, it's a forbidden word, but it's a great power, the third superhuman virtue.
You know the list which contains hope and faith and something certain.
If you produce the activation, the actualization of these three virtues in your class, and you can, you give the man the education to which he is entitled. Because you lift him up for the first time, this little recruit, this little freshman, this little sophomore, to the year 1952. When I say to a man, he's a potential teacher, when a father says to his son, you are my son, I put him for the first time into the on the historical scene of this year. Before he's just on a playground, he's out of time. And education, gentlemen, means to place a man between the former and the next generation. There has been so much press about education that I thought I should end up my analysis of teaching, instruction, and training by summing up what all these three things together do. They educate a man. But to educate is not to mold a man, is not to put a man in a Protestant bag, you see, to pull his nose or to kick him in the pants, to change him. But it is to lift him up in the position as a potential teacher, as a son, between you and the next generation of people to be instructed. You have educated a man when he takes his place in the stream of time at his proper moment. And then I assure you, I have instructed recruits in the most boring way. I have always found it interesting in the feeling that I can help to place these people into their righteous time. We are not contemporaries if we are not educated. And you as instructors on our campuses can heal the wounds which have been slain to the education and academic body, to the whole youth of America, by allowing them to remain playboys, by never lifting them up in a truly educational process into the situation of potential fathers, of potential teachers. Thank you.